My name is Anita and I'm an alcoholic. I was given the gift of sobriety December 18, 2010. And for that, I am truly grateful. I don't know why I was the first name. I hope you're not disappointed. I'm grateful to be here. And Chris, thank you for asking. I'm so tired of just coming off a couple of 12-hour shifts. And so I'll be returning tomorrow, actually driving to Austin. I said I was given the gift of sobriety December 18, 2010. And I truly mean that it is truly a gift. I had no idea, you know, when I came into AA, it was just about how can I stop drinking. Now, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So within in AA, I keep with singleness of purpose. However, Chris has informed me this is a 12-step program. So then that gives me a little leeway to, you know, share my experience, because I'm the type of alcoholic that when I did drink and someone said, hey, hit this, hey, try this, I didn't pause and say, hey, what kind of side effects is it going to get? I just say, okay, and I'd hit it. So my alcoholism opened the door for other outside issues, i.e. drugs. I live in San Antonio. That's my home. I'm a Texas transplant by way of Hollywood, Florida, as we call it, the real Hollywood. And I grew up in a wonderful family. You know, I had parents and just me and my brother growing up. I knew that my parents were much older than most of my friends' parents. That was one thing that stood out. My mom was a teacher. She'd come out to the school and I'd notice, you know, my friends would always ask, are those your grandparents? And I'm like, no, those are my parents. And, you know, I always had this weird feeling and I have this dream that I was different. And, you know, I was raised in a family that, you know, taught me values, took me to church. I'm also a recovering Southern Baptist. I'll get into that later. They taught me values, you know, gave me the best, you know, that I know that I was privileged more than a lot of kids. And, but I always felt like an outsider looking in, and I could not explain it. Even as a little kid, and I would always have this dream, repeated dream of a woman floating in and I would always ask my parents, am I adopted? And they'd go, no, where did you get that from? And I'd tell them about the dream and they'd say, no, you're not adopted. So, you know, my parents would have different meetings and, you know, belong to different organizations. My mom never drank, smoked, cursed, any of that. She was a devout Baptist. And my dad, on the other hand, he would drink occasionally, but he wasn't a big drinker, maybe two beers at the most. And but I was always the kid. If my parents said, don't touch it, all I heard was touch it. If they said, don't do that, all I heard was do that. And so I did a lot of that. And I remember the first time my dad had a fraternity meeting or something, and I went into the little bar and poured a glass of whiskey. You know, I hear old timers talk about, I couldn't wait to do it again. It was the most, I didn't have that experience. It was the most god awful. I don't even remember if I got it. I'm sorry, what happened? Okay. It was the most god awful taste. You know, I remember this burning sensation going all the way down, like I could feel it to my toes. And I was a kid, probably about 8 or 9 years old. So I don't think, and I know at that time I didn't say, ooh, I can't wait to do that again. I thought that was horrible. Why would anybody want to drink liquor? And, you know, things were, Hollywood is located between Fort Lauderdale and Miami. And, you know, as we got a little older, about 11 years old, our parents decided they wanted to move us into the country. So we moved to Florence, South Carolina, and we lived in a beautiful neighborhood and went to school there. And, you know, I played on the band. I played sax on the band. I played basketball. But, I look back at how weird I was compared to other students. Most athletes, if you played basketball, you hung out with, you know, basketball players or jocks. If you played on the band, you hung out with other band members. And I never did. I would go to whatever class, suit up, go whatever practice is required, do it and leave. And I was one of those persons that would start projects and quit. Back in the day, they used to have rules. In South Carolina, the high school that I went to, you could get a permit to smoke. They had a smoking section. I know a lot of youth cannot believe that there was a smoking section, and you had to have a note from your parents to get permission to smoke. Of course, my parents would never do that. So I did like any other healthy, normal kid, and I snuck in the bathroom and smoked and hung out with that crowd. I felt more at home with the kids who were drinking and smoking than I did with the band members or with the basketball players. And I met this girl, I think my junior year, she was a sophomore, and we would wait for the school bus in the morning. And I lived in a community called Terra Village, and we would walk down to the Terra Village market while we're waiting on the bus. And we bought this bottle. So I know a lot of young people think that the alcohol laws have always been on the books forever. They have not. We would walk down to the Terra Village market and no one carded us. We were in high school. I don't ever remember anybody asking us for ID. And we get a bottle of Thunderbird and strawberry soda and drink the entire bottle before I got to homeroom. And I fell in love with Thunderbird. I thought Thunderbird was classy because they had this cool commercial on when I was growing up. I found out later on I was drinking Rot Gut, but they used to have this commercial that used to say, "What's the word, Thunderbird? What's the action? Satisfaction." And so I would always go and get me that Thunderbird. I found out later it was like drinking Mad Dog 2020. I didn't know. I was like, drinking that Thunderbird. And by the time I got to homeroom, alcohol was just pouring from my pores, and I get a big pack of this gum called Big Red, and I'd put like the whole pack of Big Red in my mouth, and other students would be like, "Don't even try it, man. We can smell it." And but thank God my homeroom teacher, Miss Boatwright, she was an alcoholic, so she was too drunk to know that I was drunk. And so, you know, I went through school just having episodes like that and trying things, smoking weed. You know, I never thought that it never crossed my mind that I had a problem because everybody was doing it. It wasn't an addiction. I never heard terms like alcoholism. I never heard terms like addiction. You know, at that age, I just thought it was just partying. And I remember when it came around for they come out every year to school and they try to recruit you to different a career day. And they had the different colleges there. And I put in, you know, several applications. But I had a dream and I had a goal and I had a plan. I'm going to go to the Air Force. So I did put in the college applications because that's what my parents required. And then I made a decision to take the ASVAB. I was going to go to the Air Force. And, was set to take my physical. And I remember my mom calling a family meeting with me and my brother, and I get to the house and she says, "Your dad and I discussed it. And we want you to pick one of the colleges that you were accepted at, preferably the one in Florida in Tallahassee, because we're planning on moving back to Florida. We don't want you to go to the Air Force." And I was 17 years old when I graduated high school. And and in my mind, I was grown. I was a seasoned adult. And I'm like, well, I'm 17. I'm grown. I'm going to the Air Force. And they said, "Well, no, you're going to pick one of the colleges." And I said, "No, I'm going to the Air Force." And my mom wasn't very good at delivery. She was not one of those touchy-feely emotional persons. And she says, as a matter of fact, "Well, this is what your mother would have wanted." And I said, "Why are you talking about yourself in third person?" And she says, "No, I mean your real mother." And so that's how I found out I was adopted. But I always used humor as a defense mechanism. I got that from my dad, and I just stuffed it down. And all I could say was, "I knew I was adopted. You guys are so old." And I walked out the room and told my brother, "Wait till you hear what mom and dad's got to tell you." I was late to get to some party. But I carried out my family's wishes, and I picked a college in Tallahassee and left for my freshman year there. Now, mind you, I told you in the beginning, I'm a recovering Southern Baptist. So I was born and raised in the church, hellfire, brimstone. You know, and I tell people my story. I walked into AA with religion, but I found God. And I'll talk about that, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. You know, when I came into AA, I can quote Genesis to Revelations, but I did not know what it meant to have a spiritual connection. And you'll hear that in the rooms, that we're not a religious program, but we are a spiritual program. And there's a chapter when you get to step two called We Agnostics, and it talks about on page 46 that we find that God does not make too hard terms for those who seek him. And that was very profound for me. And I was like, wow, God doesn't make too hard terms. Man does. And I go off to my freshman year, and mind you, a kid coming from, born and raised in the church and freedom away from home at last. I was at every frat party, sorority party. I even had a special mug that I carried with me, you know, for emergency in case there was a cake party going on. And I drank. I did more drinking than I did going to class. My freshman year, I ended up on academic probation. And, you know, also when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, not only I spoke two languages, I spoke English and I spoke Vietnamese. I spoke Vietnamese very fluently. Vietnamese. Oh, gosh, you don't know what I've been through. Oh, poor me. Oh, poor me. Pour me another drink. I barely made it through school. So I finished 2 years at Florida A&M University. And I came back home to South Florida and then enrolled in college there, and where I became a career student because I couldn't be a serious student because it interfered with my drinking. I'm rolled back in Tallahassee. When I was in college, my freshman year, a senior who was our resident assistant in the dorm took a liking to me and took me under her wings. And I'll never forget the first day she told me, they were teaching me this game called quarters. And the object, if you lose, you have to take a drink. So I would purposely lose. And I remember thinking to myself, if you lose, you got to take a drink. That sounds like a win. And so, you know, I would constantly try to lose at quarters so I could stay drunk. I was always getting alcohol poisoning. So I remember one night the RA assistant, Karen, says, "Hey, Anita, have you ever tried Coke?" And I said, "No." And she says, "Well, I'm going to take you to a house party tonight. You're going to try it tonight." And I said, "Oh, okay." And I did. And oh, my God, freedom. I felt like an S on my chest, like Superman. I was like, "Woo! I could fly." It was amazing. I could drink all I wanted without getting poisoning. I didn't get sick. So I found the answer to allow me to continue to drink was cocaine. So I continued to use those combinations for the next 25 years. You know, we may not have the same experiences, but we pretty much have similar stories. You know, they tell you when you walk in the rooms to look for the similarities instead of the differences. You might have taken a different highway to get there, but we always ended up in the same places. It was just one more party after a party, and my drinking hadn't gotten me into trouble yet. In the 90s, I was probably like 20, 21 when both of my parents died within a couple of years of each other. So I was on my own, and I literally felt like I was a 12-year-old, 15-year-old in a 20-year-old body. I didn't know how to take care of myself. My parents were my enablers. I didn't know how to balance a checkbook, anything like that. So I had a really good job, and I kept the party going. I had a really good job, a nice condo, until I didn't have a good job, until I didn't have a nice condo. And then I was couch surfing. And, you know, just before I moved to Texas, I was involved in a toxic relationship that ended. I was the type of alcoholic. If you got enough liquor in me and we're sitting at the bar and our eyes meet, the next thing you hear is the U-Haul backing up. You know, we're moving in together. I'm gonna take care of you and your four kids. You know? And that was repeat. I had the most toxic relationships. Now the truth of the toxic relationship is when I walked into AA, they were the ones who were toxic. Because I was a catch, and I don't know how they all dogged me out like that until we got to this little thing called four step and I got to see my mistakes. So I come to, uh, I get I get carjacked about 2 years before I moved to Texas, and it was a gang of women. Several cars pulled up behind me. Anyway, they stumped me into several broken ribs. I ended up in the trauma unit, and I walked out AMA because they stopped doing anything. They didn't tape your ribs anymore. You just had to wear it out. I left AMA, had my girlfriend at the time to pick me up because I figured the best pain relief would be to go home and drink and have some cocaine, and then I'd probably be able to breathe better with the broken ribs. A year later, I had already gotten out of that relationship. I had a new fresh hostage by that time, and was at a block party and got stabbed several times in the back. And I remember being discharged from the hospital. I went to a payphone. Yes, youngsters, there's a little thing before the cell phones came out called a payphone. if you had to have some change, about a quarter, to get to the payphone. I remember going to the payphone and calling some family here in Texas and saying, you know what we do when we're broken. I want to change my life. And I said, I want to come to Texas and change my life. And they said, okay. They sent me a one-way ticket to come here. And I meant it. You know, I know I'm not the only alcoholic or addict who has hit that bottom where you say, I don't want to do this no more. I can't do this no more. I want to change. This is not going to happen again. And you meant it from your core. If you would have put me on a lie detector test, I would have passed because I did mean it. But once I take alcohol in my system, the big book talks about that. I kick off that allergy and then the phenomena of craving. You know, I meant what I said. What happened last week will never happen again. I meant that. But the minute I'm just going to have one drink tonight, which is the biggest lie any alcoholic has ever said. I'm just going to have one drink tonight. That's like an addict saying, I'm only going to have one hit. And, you know, so I did that repeatedly. I came to Texas. My family helped me get on my feet. And I got back enrolled in school and decided to, I was already in the medical field, but I decided to get a license as an RN. However, prior to that, just before I got accepted to the nursing program, I had bought a brand new sports car and I had paid one payment and went out to celebrate being accepted to the nursing program. And my sixth glass of brandy is when I lost count and apparently ended in an alcoholic blackout and wrapped my car around a tree. A light pole within a block from my house. And it never dawned on me for a second that I got a problem. Oh my God, what has happened? You need to get some help. Never dawned on me for a second. I said the first thought when I got out of jail was, okay, you're getting a little older. It just seems your reflexes, you can't drink as much as you did. And you probably need to switch from dark liquor and drink just the public vodka. And I did that constantly. Okay, you need to stop drinking that cheap vodka and start drinking top shelf, that Belvedere, that, you know, Goose. And but I found out if you drink this much vodka, you still get drunk, no matter if it's top shelf, low shelf, whatever shelf. Which reminds me, I was speaking at a conference one time and an old timer walked up to me afterwards and he says, you know, I don't know anything about Grey Goose and Belvedere. I used to drink rot gut. I'd drink Wild Irish Rose. I wasn't privy to all that good liquor. As if he was saying my alcoholism didn't count. And I said, sir, you are correct. But let me explain something to you. It doesn't matter if you got drunk in Martha's Vineyards or if you got drunk in the hood. Incomprehensible demoralization still tastes the same. Period. Incomprehensible demoralization still tastes the same. It doesn't matter where you come from. Alcoholism does not discriminate. It does not. We have all felt that. I don't want to live no more. I don't have the courage to kill myself. But I can't do this another day. There were times I hoped that I snorted enough coke just to die. That I drank enough liquor. There were times, you know, when my mom was offered me when I got ready, she would help me look for my biological parents. And by the time they got older and real sick, I couldn't bring it to, they raised me. That's my parents. I know who tucked me in at night. I know who read me bedtime stories. I know who dragged me to church willingly or not willingly, but tried to instill moral values in me. Those are my parents. Fast forward, I start doing the same thing. I go ahead and start the nursing program, and I do what is called a declaratory order. I did my probation and got it dropped, had a lawyer dropped it to misdemeanor, and the board allowed me to sit to take the NCLEX. I'm a registered nurse. I go ahead, and within a year of practicing as a nurse, within a year, it don't get better. I'm living a double life. I got my uniform on, looking preppy, got my stethoscope on. I am the shiznit walking around. My friend's like, "Ooh, you're an RN." I'm like, "I am." And driving my truck up to the trap house. It got so to the point, I was so wrapped into my disease that I didn't even bother changing out a uniform. I drive up to the trap house with a stethoscope on my uniform, and then probably 5 minutes into that, I'm like, "Oh, let me take a badge off. I don't want anybody to see my name." You know, making deals, you know, and fast forward, it just kept getting worse. And I was going from relationship to relationship, what we do, because I'm constantly trying to fill that God hole. And I always surround myself with women who, I never dated women who did alcohol or drugs. I don't know if I consciously did that. I never said, "Oh, she does alcohol or drugs." I just never did. I just think in my subconscious mind, both of us can't be wired. You know, somebody got to pay some bills, you know. I made sure to keep some. But now I look back at my relationships after doing my sex inventory, how sick and twisted that was and how sick they were. Because why would you stay with me? There's something that's untreated Al-Anon that you want to sit here and try to fix me, put up with my bull. There's something wrong with that. And so I take my NCLEX and all this other stuff. Within a year after that, my connection did not deliver at 3 a.m. in the morning. So I decide to get in my car with no tinted windows, and it stands out like a sore thumb. 3 o'clock in the morning, I drive to the east side of San Antonio to get some street pharmacy. And you know what I did that made perfect sense? I wonder if anyone else ever did this. I saw a strange man walking along the street. Actually, I can't get out in this part of town. Why don't I pick the strange man out and say, "Hey, you can score for me, bruh?" Makes sense. I feel safe. I did that repeatedly. Now, if that wasn't an example of there's a power greater than myself, not only that restored me to sanity, but kept a hedge of protection around me. I don't know why you felt favor in my life, because we see the horror stories anytime we turn on the news. I could have been choked out plenty of days. I don't know how or why I'm still alive. But this particular trip, 3 o'clock in the morning, instead of making a right and jumping on 35, I made a left to go to the bootleg liquor store because I needed something to wash the cocaine down with. And of course, before you knew it, they were playing my favorite song. Whoop, whoop, pull over. Yep. In my uniform. And I'm in tears. And the alcohol and the cocaine tells me, "Why don't you yell this a few times? Because surely the cops will let you go. I'm a nurse. Hey, you can't do this. I'm a nurse." Which kind of ticked them off even more. So it takes the board several years to investigate. So I was still able to practice and all this other shenanigans. My drinking really spiraled out of control. I was doing a travel assignment at one time, a travel assignment in the next city, New Brunswick, for $42 an hour. And I tell you the amount for this reason, $42 an hour. Had a beautiful condo with a nice walk-in pantry. I had a bag of flour. I'm sorry. I'm so grateful, Chris, that you had me come and talk, because sometimes if nobody else needs to hear it, we need to hear it. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I had a family member that loved me so much unconditionally. She knew that I was high. I would deny it for so long till I could stop denying it. And after a while, they'd knock on the door and they'd go, "Are you high?" And I go, "Yes. Take me to the store to get some groceries." And they'd take me to the store and fill up my pantry, because all I had was a bag of flour. I'd be starving, going days, making $42 an hour. Don't even have money to do my laundry. I'm washing my uniform out on. But, you know, I grew up in a family with presentations, everything. You fix yourself up in the morning, put that uniform on and put that stethoscope and get to the job and people telling you what a good charge nurse you are. They don't even understand that by the time 2 or 3 hours after leaving here, I'm going to be liquored up and coked up. 2010 rolls around. I have to pay the piper and the board says, we want you to appear in Austin. And I just needed one more drink to get my head straight. One more drink to get my head straight. One more drink to get my head straight. And I couldn't show up for my hearing. April 23rd, 2010, the board deemed me unfit to practice and revoked my license. That's all I ever wanted to be was a nurse. Not suspended, revoked. July of that same year comes around. I don't know what to do. I can't go on like this. And I'm on the foot of my bed with cocaine in one hand and a bottle of vodka in the other, crying and saying, God, why have you forsaken me? What did I do so wrong? I never stopped believing that there was a God, but by this point, I felt like he stopped believing in me and he wasn't helping me. If he was helping me, I've been begging you, take this away from me. I hear all these stories. Other people are like, ooh, and then I prayed and I was healed instantly. I didn't have that healed instantly story. I guess I had to take some action. So July rolls around, July 7th, I'm on my knees. It's my birthday. And I said, God, after my birthday, because of course you don't quit on your birthday. I was like, after my birthday, I'm going to quit. And, but of course I drank and I kicked off the allergy and the phenomena of craving. And about a week later, I was still drinking. And the news says, I don't remember, of course, apparently I was in a blackout. I walked out in traffic and got hit by a car. I woke up at the end of August, intubated on a neuro ICU unit with my family at the foot of the bed. My head was shaved. I had staples down the middle of my head, multiple cranial surgery, subdural hematoma, and what is called a subarachnoid bleed. And I had short-term memory loss. I couldn't walk from here to the door without breaking down in tears because I couldn't remember what I got up for. And I said, oh my God. And the doctor explained to me the part of the brain that was damaged would affect my short-term memory. I said, I can tell you how blood is oxygenated through the systemic system. And I go through all this. He says, not your long-term, your short-term. So I knew I would never practice nursing again. I refused to go to rehab, physical rehab. They discharged me. I'm on a rolling walker with my head shaved. And I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. I have to apply for disability. I'm 2 months behind, 2 or 3 months behind on my condo. They've repoed my Ram, Dodge Ram. And I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. And so finally, I had to move out. And I asked a family member, I asked my brother, and he let me stay there about 2 months until, they discharged me with seizure medications and Klonopin, and I used vodka to wash that down. My very first day coming into my condo after being discharged on a rolling walker, I walked in shaking and I said, wow, you just survived a coma. Celebration. And I poured a glass of whiskey to celebrate. People asked me, oh my God, who does that? What's in an alcoholic? Makes perfect sense because I don't have a solution. The worst thing you can do for an alcoholic is to take away my bottle without a sufficient substitute. I thought that was such a powerful story. I stay in the rooms long enough and I hear other speakers and I go, dang, I didn't do that. The things we do. What else are we going to do? I don't have a solution. You expect me to go through this sober? So I go by that December, I have burnt all my bridges and all my enablers in my family decided they were tired and they cut me off and they dropped me off at this transformational place here in San Antonio called Haven for Hope, a homeless shelter. I surrendered December 18th and walked into the treatment center and I haven't found it necessary to alter my head, my thinking. I haven't found it necessary. I haven't done it. So don't get it twisted. That doesn't mean I'm cured. All I have is a daily reprieve. when I hear people tell me, oh, I got 20, 30 years of sobriety. So you know, I come to meetings because of the spiritual program, because drinking is not an option. Of course, drinking is an option. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's always going to be an option. I've met many women who are 33 years of sobriety and relapse. Why? Because alcoholism is a subtle foe. It tells us on page 85, it is easy for us to let up on our spiritual program of action and to rest on our laurels. We're in trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe, subtle, sneaky, cunning. Foe, meaning enemy. A foe is your enemy. He's the subtle enemy. Alcohol is a subtle foe. We're never cured of alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve. That means today. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I don't want to run out of time, so I want to tell you this. I walked into AA, walked into treatment, and they were bringing meetings every night, 7 nights a week, NA, CA, AA, all of these. And so I had no intentions of quitting drinking. I'm going to treatment to get rid of this cocaine problem. So I joined CA. And I remember my first sponsor, and I was like, yeah, I just want to get a grip on this cocaine. She says, yeah, and everything, yeah, and alcohol. I said, oh, yeah, the alcohol, I've already made a plan. I'm going to cut back and, special occasions and things like that. She's like, oh, no. Sobriety means, like, you don't drink. And I'm like, forever? And she's like, forever. I'm like, forever? Like, forever, ever? She's like, forever, ever. And I was like, okay. I didn't know if I was going to stick with that or not, but I was in treatment, so I had to listen to what she said. So we started working the steps. And I would try to drag my feet, but she didn't let me because she told me we were on a life or death errand. We talked about step one, powerlessness and unmanageability. You know, we admitted that our lives had become unmanageable. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. And we talked about those two words, powerlessness and unmanageability. Then we went to step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And we talked about insanity and sanity. Insanity, lunacy. Sanity, sound mind. I didn't know what it meant to have a sound mind in so long. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. She had me read 60 to 63, and I learned the third step prayer, and it said, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thy will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of thy love, thy power, thy way of life. May I do thy will. 7 times it says thy will, not my will. Don't say nothing about me. That's total and utter absolute surrender. The victory over there may build witness to those that I would help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Am I perfect at this? No. But that's what I liked about AA. Page 60 said, we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Now, mind you, progress means to change. Now, you can't be in here doing the same dope fiend moves 10 years later talking about spiritual progress. No, progress means you are making some change. So I go ahead and surrender. I get on, I get this fire into my belly. I get out of treatment in 60 days. I go into an Oxford Sober Living. I join a home group and I get on the bus. I'm taking 2 buses. I've lost everything. All I did was sit in treatment and talk about, I used to have this. I used to have a Dodge Ram. I had a condo. I had this. I had this. I had this. And one day it hit me. You never had things. Things had you. I thought that was the measure. I was no good without those things. I got my first job at that same homeless shelter in 2012, and I was so grateful. Making $13 an hour, and I was like, okay. And I ended up moving up as a case manager. And so the St. Mary's Law team saw the work I was doing and represented me, because apparently I had suspended license, over $6,000 in tickets all in about 6 different counties. And Bexar County excused my tickets, but the other neighboring counties was like, congratulations on your sobriety, but we still want our money. And so that's called step 9. You still got to make financial amends. So I did that. got my license. Then they said, we're going to represent you because the IRS is coming after you. It looks like while you were drinking and drugging, you didn't pay taxes for about 3-4 years. And I went before the IRS, and the guy at the hearing says, how come you didn't pay taxes? And I wasn't even trying to speak victimese for the first time in my life. What am I going to lie about? It's the truth. I said, I was drinking and drugging. I don't know what to tell you, sir. I was high. He said, you mean to tell me you couldn't put a stamp on an envelope and mail the money in? I said, I could not. And even if I did have the money and a stamp and an envelope, that would be cutting into my drinking money. I'm not trying to make excuses, sir. I'm willing to do whatever it is. I don't have thousands of dollars to give you right now in one lump sum. I just got sober, so I'm not. But if you make a plan with me. He was so moved that I was honest. He said, nobody ever came in and said, oh, I didn't pay you because I was high. He put a 2-year freeze on collecting from me. So I have since started paying off student loans, IRS, and I owe out of the thousands of dollars that I owed when I got sober, I'm down to $1,600 on the IRS. So that's amazing. The same St. Mary's Law team came to me and said, hey, Anita, we think we can petition the board to have you reinstated. I said, get out of here. Who's going to reinstate me? The drugs, the alcohol. They set a date for me. August 2013, I went and got a hotel in Austin so I could go to 333 Waterloo Bay. And I came in with a team of lawyers. But the Texas Board of Nursing don't play. They were like, nice to meet you, and had my lawyer sit in the corner because you won't be opening your mouth here, and had me sit at the boardroom table. And it hit me. I came here to petition the board, but I had never made a step 9 amends to the board. I said, before we go any further, I want to thank you for allowing me to come here to petition the board today. And I want to make amends because I was wrong, because you instilled the lives of others in my hand and I abused that. So whatever your answer is, whether it's yes or no, I just want to thank you for the privilege and the honor. Usually a week later, they give you their decision. By the time they got through grilling me, they told me to sit outside. We're going to make a decision today. And they called me back in 5 minutes. It was like a hearing. I was like, 5 minutes, that can't be good. They got a decision. They called me back in and said, Ms. Mitchell, we're reinstating you with stipulations. And I had to go through 3 years of stipulations. And on that day, August 1st, 2013, my license was reinstated. My very first job was a director of nursing. I don't serve an itty bitty God, because itty bitty gods do itty bitty things. I needed to create a God that was all loving. That hellfire brimstone punishing wasn't working for me. Because the fact is, if I wasn't worthy and I wasn't good enough, why not just let me die there on the table? Why not, when I got stabbed, let me die? Not let, when I got shot at, let me catch a bullet. If my life is not, you know, when I got sober, I didn't care what other people thought about me. I didn't care about me. You know, today it matters to me. How do I want to be remembered? I don't want to be a great person. I want, if I die today, somebody to walk into my funeral and people go, who is that? And they say, Anita brought the message one day and I decided I'm going to take the steps and I'm going to do what my sponsor says and I'm going to work the steps. And I haven't had a drink since. Then I feel like my living hasn't been in vain. My living has not been in vain. I'm right now a travel nurse doing COVID relief in Austin, Texas, and I'm very honored. I'm at an awesome hospital. I'll be heading back there tomorrow morning. I'm a cardiovascular nurse. So I just want to say that this COVID hit us hard. I've gone through a lot of experiences. I've been working in the hospital since the late 88 and 90s. Never experienced anything like this before. I sponsor a lot of women. And the reason I sponsor a lot of women, because that's how many I need to keep the voices in my head quiet. And I tell my sponsees, when they tell me, Anita, can we go back through the steps again? I go, oh, okay. Oh, you ready to go back through the steps? Oh, you want to go back? You want me to go through the steps over again? First of all, stop asking your sponsee. I'll tell you why. Stop asking us to go back through the steps. I asked her, so how many sponsees do you have? Oh, I don't have any sponsors. Oh, you haven't started sponsoring? No, I haven't. Oh, well, honey, we can't go through the steps. because you haven't finished the step. It's 12 steps. You've done the 11 step program. Step 12 gives us clear cut instructions. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message. Nobody asking you to be perfect. We try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. When somebody asked me, I don't think I'll be a good sponsor. I said, did you get drunk or high? Yeah. Did you wreck shop and roar through the lives of others like a tornado? Yeah. Did you work the 12 steps? Yes, I did. Congratulations. You're a sponsor. All it is one drunk talking to another. It's not rocket science. Bill W. and Dr. Bob said, this dude, when she begged, she said, please talk to this man. Bill, he's like, no, Dr. Bob had tried everything. She said, come on, he's waiting. He wants to talk to you. Dr. Bob said he's got 15 minutes. 15 minutes, I say. What started off as a 15-minute talk turned into 6 hours. Dr. Bob did not want him to leave because this man, Bill, got through another drunk, got through to him where psychiatrists and learned professionals could not get through to him. You can't tell me nothing unless you walked in my shoes. You know? December just passed in the pandemic, 2020. My life will never be the same. My oldest sponsee, tomorrow is her 10-year sobriety. I'll be giving her 10-year chip. My oldest sponsee called me over to the house to give me a Christmas gift. I go to drive to her house. She gives me an envelope. And I, being the selfish alcoholic that I am, I was thinking, I drove all the way over here for a Christmas card? Oh, okay. And I'm feeling the card because I'm an alcoholic. I'm feeling the card. I'm like, I don't feel a gift card in here. She says, we're talking. I said, well, thanks, B. I appreciate it. Give her a hug. She says, Captain, I want you to open it. And I open the card, and it's a beautiful Christmas card. But inside is a fold-up piece of paper, white piece of paper. And on it, I open the white piece of paper, and it says 23andMe with a tracking number. She bought 23andMe and had it delivered. They know I've been looking for my family. I've tried Ancestry, all this. But I was hoping maybe I'll find a sibling. You know, I had a little hope. All of a sudden, spirit came over me, and I started shaking the envelope. And I told her, I have a good feeling. I got a good feeling about this. I took the sample, sent it in February 23rd. I'm sorry. February 23rd, not only did I find a half sibling, I found a full sister who's been living in Dallas this whole time. I found my biological mother. I found my biological father. I finished my assignment in Tyler, Texas, June 5th. June 8th, they flew me to Kissimmee, Florida, to the reunion resort where we all spent the week. There's no one who can replace the parents that raised me, but I just have a bigger family now. My first instinct was to try to guilt this woman. And then my sponsor gave me direction. You've been looking for these people all your life. This woman is 76 years old. You have an opportunity to let her enjoy the remaining. This woman's looked for me for so many years. And she cried. When I called her that night and I said, hi, this is Anita. I heard a scream. My baby, my baby. And I wanted to share that with you because none of this would have been possible had it not been for Alcoholics Anonymous. Whatever your fellowship is, whether it's NACA, it had not been possible had I not done the work. These steps are not just designed to keep a pipe or a coke out of your hand or meth or whatever your drug of choice. It's not just designed to keep you from not drinking. It is literally a design for living. 2019, I started a meeting in San Antonio called the Design for Living. We are now meeting in person. And I'm so grateful I got to go the last Saturday. And I asked God if he would deliver me from this horrible, horrible affliction that I would spend the rest of my life carrying this message. I'm so grateful for my sobriety. I know you don't know me, but I know each and every one of you because I've walked in your shoes, and I pray a hedge of protection and long sobriety for each and every one of you. I just want to end this on page 164. I know you've heard it 100 times, but you're going to hear it 101 more times. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. we shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you drudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless and keep you until then. Thank you for my sobriety.
That was a great, beautiful Anita.
Yeah, I love that story.
That was really a beautiful story.
Thank you, Anita. That was amazing.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.